Saturday with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again. Well, last year, October 7th fell on a Saturday, and on that day it was clear from early on that Hamas militants had breached the Israeli border and there would be major consequences. A devastating massacre of around 900 civilians and 300 soldiers. There was hundreds of people taken hostage as well from a music festival near the Gaza border and also by villages or kibbutzim near the border as well. And since then, more than 40,000 people have been killed in the Israeli bombing of Gaza. Tens of thousands more are missing. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. Disease and famine-like conditions threatening the lives of thousands more on the strip has become largely a wasteland with buildings and infrastructure destroyed, and now those who have survived facing into a winter with little shelter and little hope of a ceasefire. Now, a lot gets lost in the fog of war. Journalists from outside Gaza haven't been able to deploy within Gaza unless embedded with the Israeli Defence Forces. But the Visual Investigations Unit at the New York Times has invested significant time and resources in drilling down into the detail of what exactly happened in a number of incidents over the last year. And that unit is headed by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Malachy Brown, who is, by the way, originally from Limerick. I've been speaking to Malachy about his work at the New York Times. I began by asking him how his unit works.
Yeah, the idea behind the team is to sort of make use of the sources and digital evidence that we can collect through social media, plane and ship trackers, satellite imagery providers, and the wider internet. And then by combining that with, you know, the regular journalism of cultivating sources and getting on the ground and talking to witnesses and subject matter experts, we can do a sort of evidence-based investigation into whatever event it is that we're looking into. And so we built a team who know how to do the digital and the traditional reporting and to connect the dots between these sort of various types of reporting. So when there is a sort of contested narrative, a government is or an army are denying some wrongdoing and lots of witnesses are saying something different, we go out and try to collect the evidence and find the truth through that evidence.
As I say, we are approaching the anniversary. Have you had cause to look into the events of October the 7th itself? Have you used your visual investigation skills to look at those events? And if so, what have you found?
Yes, we have. We collected, you know, quite a number of videos. I would say tens of thousands of videos of that day, and analyzed them. What you can see there is, like, it was just a sort of a shock and awe attack. You know, Hamas had prepared meticulously for it. They had incredible level of intelligence about, you know, the fence, how they were going to get through it, how they would overpower military bases and the kibbutzim that they would, you know, so brutally attack. You know, they had maps, they had an operational plan for each one. They had the number of motorbikes, of guns, of gunmen, of mobile phones that they needed. They had a very slick media propaganda element to all of this. Their videos were coming out, you know, within a couple of hours of the attack unfolding. We look back at their training videos and it shows them planning exactly what they would do, like blasting open the fences, laying down ramps over sort of concrete walls for their motorcycles, gunmen on paragliders, you know, taking hostages. They simulated building these kibbutzim and taking hostages and killing people. They even circulated a diagram to their fighters of where to aim their RPGs at Israel's Merkava tanks to disable them. And you see that happening in the footage on the day. Yeah, it was a horrific attack. And they sent their best fighters, their best trained fighters called the Nukba, who were the kind of vanguard of the attack, to the military bases. And then they had other waves that came through afterwards and again joined in the base attacks to sustain them, but also took on the kibbutzim at the same time. Like in one document, they had the response time of various IDF units who would come to defend one kibbutz. And so they cut off the roadways and they attacked those bases. And then that roadway with loads of kibbutzim south from there just, like, you know, turned into sort of a massacre. It was really horrific footage.
And did you get any insight into, I mean, one of the contested spaces in the conflict in Gaza is the IDF's accusation that there are militants using hospitals, there are people working within those hospitals who deny that. Have you turned your attention to that and have you drawn any conclusions?
Yeah, we looked into that because Israel really justified their enclosing around hospitals and really shutting down healthcare in Gaza by saying that there were Hamas had these command and control centers, particularly under al-Shifa. They described it as like a multi-story control center that was like the size of a New York metro station. And what they found was, yes, there was a tunnel into the grounds of the hospital, but very little else. And they found some weapons there as well, they said in videos that they put out. But it's hard to make sense of all of that and whether it was, you know, a justified target, given how little that they found there. In other cases, you know, there was a hospital called the Qatari Hospital, I believe, where, again, you know, they're surrounding it and they send in their bulldozers and they tip over what looks like a tunnel. But actually, and they said this is proof that Hamas has tunnels leading down under this hospital. And what we looked into it, we talked to engineers who built the hospital and looked at archival imagery of it. And it's actually just, you know, a latch down to water that supplies hydrotherapy pools. You know, there's been any number of investigations that we've done over the last year. One recent one was, you know, when the IDF had closed in around northern Gaza and there were street battles going on. You might remember that, you know, civilians who were fleeing the area also came under fire and several of them were killed. And our team investigated one entire family who was killed on the street. And we concluded that it was Israeli soldiers who killed them as they were coming back from burying their child who had also been shot earlier in the day. And they were holding aloft a white flag. And that's just one story in what's been a horrific year for Gaza. But it's representative of something that was happening at that time, wasn't really acknowledged by the IDF at the time. Behavior didn't really change. And the only time really that they kind of went out and addressed the issue is when IDF soldiers killed three of their own. And so it was a persistent...
This was three hostages who had surrendered. They were wearing no tops. They didn't present any obvious threat, but they were shot by members of the IDF. And it called into question maybe how other people who appeared to be surrendering were being treated in this conflict by the IDF.
Exactly, yeah. So it kind of, the investigations that we look at, you know, might touch into a broader pattern of behavior, either by Hamas or the other militant groups or the IDF. Another investigation that we did examined, you know, how frequently Israel was bombing the south of Gaza early in the war, where it had told the population to flee to for safety. You know, again, some of your listeners might be familiar with, you know, videos of or pictures of the huge craters that were left behind in some of the attacks. And those were evidence of 2,000-pound bombs being dropped in these highly populated areas. And we wanted to see how frequently they were being used. And by taking satellite imagery and training an AI algorithm to detect the craters left behind by these weapons, we were able to identify over 1,500 craters and then narrowing it down, several hundred 2,000-pound bombs being dropped in November last year, you know, in the early stages of the conflict.
And you train the algorithm to be able to exclude historical craters on the strip as well and focus only on recent ones.
Yeah, it's never just the results of the technology. You have a reporter that's reviewing them, but it will detect them for you. And so like a water tower with a shadow looks quite like a crater. So we'll train the machine that's a false positive, but also take historic imagery and then manually rule out, well, this is a 2,000-pound bomb that was dropped in a previous campaign. And so these are, you know, we're assured that these are fresh craters.
Now, you're a global news organisation, but you're obviously a major US news organisation. The 2,000-pound bombs that you mentioned that were being dropped in the course of this offensive that you were able to get satellite visual imagery on and do other investigations on have been provided by the United States. So what's the reaction been in the political sphere to your investigations amongst your own audiences? Has it had a wider ripple effect? Has it in any way influenced the debate about this conflict in the US?
Well, you know, I think it's hard to say what breaks through, especially in the US, because it's such a polarizing issue, this conflict. But, you know, after that report came out and other reports as well about, you know, the frequency in which these bombs were being used in dense areas, you know, Biden came out and criticized that behavior. Now, we can't attribute it to our report, but after that, they stopped exporting them. But the US continues to send weapons over, you know, different types of weapons.
And that was Malachy Brown, who is head of the investigation, the visual investigations unit at the New York Times. Now, still with us in studio, our Minister Neil Richmond Fine Gael, TD for Dublin Rathdown. We have Jennifer Whitmore, Social Democrats TD for Wicklow, and Thomas Pringle, Independent TD for Donegal. Neil Richmond, to you first. What Malachy Brown finished up by talking about there was the dropping of 2,000-pound US manufactured bombs into Gaza. Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, is going to meet Joe Biden soon. Will he communicate to Joe Biden his view on how adequate the response of the US and the international community has been in the eyes of the Irish government?
Absolutely. As he has done every chance he has got, be there engagement with world leaders at the UN or indeed at every single European Council meeting, and indeed with his conversations held 2 weeks ago with the President of Palestine, when the President thanked him, the Irish government, more importantly the Irish people and body politic generally, for their consistent support of the people who are under siege in Gaza. This conflict, like a year this day, has been absolutely horrendous. You'd know better than me, Colin, but I'd imagine it's probably the worst year since the decades-long conflicts that have beset this region. And it's something that we've consistently said, that we have to de-escalate, that we have to use every means to de-escalate, that there's a responsibility particularly on the United States, but then in relation to the actions of Israel. And we will, as an Irish government representing the Dáil, not stop being vocal at a European level to move everything. We'll continue our support of the Palestinian people, of UNRWA and everything else. And every day this conflict goes on, there is just so many civilians, particularly in Gaza, who are just going to suffer more and more.
OK, we have a war in Lebanon at the moment. The conflict in Gaza is continuing. I suppose a largely forgotten aspect of this is the situation on the West Bank, where violence has flared up. There's been international concern over the violence that's been perpetrated by settlers on illegal settlements in the West Bank. But since the International Court of Justice has ruled that they are illegal and that there should be a withdrawal from the occupied territories, where is the legal advice on the Occupied Territories Bill in Ireland at the moment? Has that fresh legal advice been formulated? When will it be delivered? And will action be seen on that before the next general election?
Well, obviously, the International Court judgment was subject to a motion at the last UN General Assembly, which was about 10 days ago. So that has to be taken into account in the legal advice. The legal advice has been very consistent and clear, provided by the Attorney General. I know other people will offer alternative legal advice from lawyers and academics, and that's fine. But we're bound by the legal advice of the Attorney General. And trade competency is an EU competency, and for a very good reason. We've consistently called for a review of the EU-Israel trade agreement, have been doing it since March at a European Council level. The Occupied Territories Bill is being reviewed legally by the Attorney General, and that will be at the request of the Taoiseach, and that will be provided to the government in due course, but I can't put an exact date
okay
on it.
Thomas Pringle, what should Simon Harris say to Joe Biden, and what's your reaction to what Neil Richmond has said about the Occupied Territories Bill?
Well, I think on the Occupied Territories Bill, two very eminent EU law specialists reviewed the Occupied Territories Bill and indeed reviewed the Attorney General's advice to the government and were shocked by it and couldn't believe that the Attorney General would give such weak advice. And actually, and it didn't seem to even appear to consider the full legal implications of the Attorney General, of the Occupied Territories Bill or EU law either. So, I mean, obviously the Attorney General will say whatever the government wants them to say, and he will find
sure,
the
I suppose
legal
just
advice for
it,
that.
It should be said that the full text of the Attorney General's advice has not been seen by these legal experts. It's the end result they're making, they're basing their analysis on. But go on.
Well, I think if the government wants to be clear about that, then publish the full text and let us all see it and let us see what the legal situation is. Because the fact of the matter is that, and Neil mentioned it there, the Attorney General is basically a legal advisor. He gives advice. Advice isn't the law, and advice should be tested as to what the law actually is, and the only people that can give clarity on that is the courts. And so basically, you can, if you pay us a letter, you'll get any advice
right,
you want.
Okay, but the Attorney General interprets the law. He's asked a question, he gives a legal interpretation. He doesn't follow orders, as it were. He provides a legal interpretation. Well, you know, there is a distinction there. Jennifer Whitmore, I suppose the same question to you. What should Simon Harris say to Joe Biden, and what's your reaction to what Neil Richmond has said about the Occupied Territories Bill?
So I suppose the first thing, the government has, and I will acknowledge, the government has been very strong in words when it comes to Israel. And I think recognising the state of Palestine was a very positive move. However, words at this stage and for quite a while are just not enough. And what we need to be seeing from Simon Harris is actions. So when you look at things that Ireland can do, I agree with Thomas, we do need to be implementing the Occupied Territories Bill. But there's other things as well that we need to be doing. So Micheál Martin before the summer said he was going to look at the issue of travel bans for violent settlers from the West Bank. There's been no movement on that. Our trade with Israel, there's 100 million euros worth of dual use exports with Israel, and the majority of that was being used by state entities within Israel, such as defence purposes.
Sure, but I suppose you'd appreciate that the trade with Israel is overseen by the EU-Israel Association Agreement. I suppose the question where the Occupied Territories Bill might come in is that that's not Israel, and there may be greater scope, although depending on the legal advice, to ban imports from there.
Yeah, so I mean, look, that's what we need to see happen. I mean, we need actions, and Israel clearly are not listening to the words from either Ireland or from the UN or the ICJ. They are not listening, they're not paying attention, and the only thing that they're going to actually listen to are sanctions. And we have to use every single lever, and the Taoiseach has said we should use every single lever. Unfortunately, okay, we haven't seen that happen yet. Okay. We need to be strong with them. It's gone on far too long.
I just want to give one final question to Neil Richmond here, and that's, the next time the European Union is advocating people signing up to a trade agreement and trying to reassure people that that trade agreement will be used to leverage adherence to labour standards and adherence to human rights, for example, like the Mercosur agreement, why should anyone believe the European Union on those assurances again, that it's not about the bottom line, it's not about anything else, or that it's not about anything else other than money, when they haven't implemented the human rights clauses of the association agreement with Israel?
Well, I've been working on EU trade law and regulations for just close to 20 years now, Colm, and the trade agreements and the Israel-EU association agreement that were signed a decade ago are completely unrecognisable to what we have today in relation to agreements with Canada and Mexico. The trading agreements have changed. The legal parameters are far stronger. They're not comparable of ones of old, but that's why we need to review it.